With my last Rachel Maddow video, I got some pushback from new followers and old followers alike. Some of the criticisms were of my show's format. They don't think it's fair if I just read articles, which I don't. I provide commentary with the articles. And the reason I do it that way isn't because of laziness. The reason I read things aloud is to serve my educational mission. I try to present things the way I would to my college students if I had access to them outside of class. In a perfect world, I would make the reading assignments in class, I would tell you all which articles to read, and then I would follow you back to your dorm rooms and make you stop playing video games long enough to pay attention to the reading. Many college students, at least in public universities, don't actually do the assigned reading. They fake it. They skim and they pay attention to other students who have done the reading when there are discussions about the reading. They go online and read summaries and synopses. They take shortcuts, and as a result, their understanding is shallow, sort of like the results of the meme approach to learning that many experience on social media. If I had time, I would read the assignments out loud to them and explain the important points as we encounter them together. I also would sprinkle in my own ideas about the reading as we went because I would want to model for them how they should interact with the reading in their own minds as they learn to do the reading themselves. In other words, I would model for them an active rather than a passive approach to interacting with and digesting new material. In short, I make no apologies for my approach on YouTube. My point is not to grow my audience or to provide confirmation bias the way Rachel Maddow does. I want to challenge those who do tune in and teach them to think. To do that, most of them will need to dive more deeply into the available reading material than they typically do. My observation is that people go on Facebook and they see an article they like and they see a title, more specifically, that they like, and they share that title without ever having read the article. I talk on this show about doing a deep dive, and that's what I mean. Actually read the article. And for some articles, not only read them, but reread them until you figure out exactly what they're trying to express. I agree that articles are more engaging than videos. Some people say it would be better for people to read the articles than watch me reading them on a video, and I agree that that might be more engaging for some people. Memes, even more so, but only to people who know how to read actively. I doubt that active readers comprise the majority on social media platforms. That is why I resort to reading so much of my material aloud. I want everyone to stop skimming and actually read, comprehend, and interact with the often life or death ideas I cover on this show. One of the most pointed criticisms came from a professional writer. And I think professional writers would do well to understand what I'm trying to say here because their bias, which can be somewhat elitist, is likely to assume that most other people interact with information the way they do. So not to mention names, Christopher Helen, but I think it would behoove you to figure out that not everyone digests and absorbs information the way you do. And memes and soundbites are perhaps not the best way to engage people in a way that helps them learn what they need to know to actually start a revolution. If your goal is just to get more people to watch your Facebook group go by, then I'd say that's kind of a stupid goal. We don't merely need numbers of people to do this job. We need people who know what they're doing and who know why they're doing it. So that's why I plan to stick with the current format of the show. But if you have suggestions, as always, feel free to put them in the comments beneath these videos. So as it turns out, there was no Russian conspiracy in the laptop scandal. We mentioned that a couple days ago, Hunter Biden's laptop was turned over to the FBI and had some very interesting information on it. It deeply implicates not only Hunter, but Joe, his father, as well. So this reporting is by Rowan Scarborough from the Washington Times. Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe said on Monday there is no evidence that Hunter Biden's explosive emails are part of a Russian disinformation campaign, specifically calling out Representative Adam Schiff for spreading the conspiracy without evidence. That probably won't stop Rachel Maddow from reporting on it, though. It's funny that some of the people who complain the most about intelligence being politicized are the ones politicizing the intelligence, Mr. Ratcliffe said, according to Fox News. Unfortunately, it is Adam Schiff who said the intelligence community believes the Hunter Biden laptop and emails on it are part of a Russian disinformation campaign. Let me be clear, Mr. Ratcliffe said. The intelligence community doesn't believe that because there is no intelligence that supports that. And we have shared no intelligence with Adam Schiff or any member of Congress. Mr. Ratcliffe appeared on Mornings with Maria, hosted on Fox Business by Maria Bartiromo. Mr. Schiff, chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, immediately blamed Russia last week without evidence after the New York Post published a number of emails from a laptop owned by Hunter, son of Democratic presidential candidate Joseph R. Biden. Mr. Schiff has consistently implied in recent years that the Russians, who hacked the Democrats' 2016 election computers, are behind various conspiracies. I don't even think it's clear that the Russians hacked the Democrats' 2016 election computers, but correct me in the menchies below if I'm wrong. Mr. Schiff and other Democrats said a Russian-tied Ukraine politician influenced a probe into Hunter Biden's finances by Republican senators. The senators said their staffs never talked to the operative or received any material. They're still just making up shit. The MacBook Pro laptop was left by Hunter Biden at a repair shop in Wilmington, Delaware in April 2019, the shop owner told the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. Mr. Biden never retrieved the machine. Smart move, kid. So after 3 months, the shop owner took possession. He was so disturbed by some of the contents that he provided the hard drive to the FBI in late 2019. He later provided copies to Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal attorney. The email cache shows Hunter Biden arranged a meeting with an executive from Ukraine's Burisma Holdings, an energy firm that placed Mr. Biden on its board of directors and paid him millions of dollars from 2014 to 2019. Mr. Biden also had a deal with a Chinese billionaire to pay him $10 million a year for introductions only. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows also made a Monday morning appearance, this one on Fox News. He suggested there is more damaging information to come tying the former vice president to wrongdoing. He also said that it is Democrats who are spreading laptop disinformation. I'm not aware of any Russian disinformation campaign that would involve these emails or this laptop, Mr. Meadows said. And no defensive briefing, to my knowledge, has been given. And so all of this narrative that is out there that would suggest that it's not real, that's the disinformation. You know, Adam Schiff came on and said, oh, this is Russia, Russia, Russia. And again, I can tell you, this is Adam Schiff once again trying to spin a story that's not accurate. I think in the days to come, you will see that Joe Biden will have a lot to answer for. And now we have a new book that warns of the imminent danger of a Kamala Harris presidency. This is by Max Perry of the Greenville Post. With the 2020 U.S. presidential election less than a month away, there is widespread speculation concerning Democratic nominee Joe Biden's mental and physical fitness at 77 years of age if he were to defeat incumbent Donald Trump on November 3rd. The former vice president and senator from Delaware would surpass his opponent as the oldest to ever hold the office of the presidency, if victorious, while his generally acknowledged cognitive decline has led many to question whether he is even capable of serving a single term. Given the concerns about his health, the likelihood that Biden's running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, would become his successor has put the controversial former prosecutor and California Attorney General's own politics under scrutiny, though not to a degree sufficient with the odds she could very well become commander-in-chief in the near future. Trump himself suggested it was the hidden motivation behind House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's recent introduction of a 25th Amendment commission on removing a mentally unfit president to enable the replacement of an incapacitated Biden with Harris after the election. Even Saturday Night Live recently joked about Biden's poor first debate performance as a Harris term in the making. But as journalist Caleb Maupin explains in his new book, Kamala Harris and the Future of America, an essay in three parts, the prospect of her becoming president is no laughing matter. Maupin's ambitious essay surpasses the redundant analysis of the vice presidential nominee by placing her political success in a broader historical context while forewarning the unique danger of a budding Harris administration waiting in the wings. The majority of the critical examinations of Harris during the campaign have critiqued her rebranding as an outwardly progressive figure in stark contrast with the reality of her career as a ruthless criminal prosecutor turned establishment politician. While that is true, Maupin's analysis takes an important step further by formulating the rise of Harris, who is the first Jamaican and South Asian American nominee on a major party ticket, as the culmination of the U.S. left's failures in the last several decades, resulting in its present deteriorated state preoccupied with liberal identity politics. More specifically, a result of the defeat suffered by the so-called New Left of the 1960s and 70s, which had long-term consequences for progressive politics in America today. I'm going to summarize the next part of the article. Maupin makes the case that because her father was a progressive like Bernie, and that her father left the family after a vicious custody dispute, leaving Kamala's mom with full custody, that Kamala is the way she is because she has so many daddy problems. It's an interesting premise, I have to say, because if you look into her father's politics, they're very good. So skipping ahead, Maupin also argues that Harris was likely groomed for her present role as Biden's running mate by the Clintonite wing of the Democratic Party once it became apparent Hillary was not in a position to run again in 2020, citing a 2017 closed-door meeting in the Hamptons with the elite party donors and apparatchiks. Despite her own early exit from the primaries after a knockout blow in the debates delivered by Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, who sharply criticized her record as a prosecutor, Harris was already vetted by the party leadership to be Biden's heir apparent. And not only by the party leadership, but also by the Hollywood cabal. Creative Artists Agency, this is me talking obviously, is part of the cabal, and they paid Kamala to come in and run against Bernie. When we had the 20 plus candidates running against Bernie at the beginning of the primary process. Michael Moore also alluded to the fact that they had chosen Kamala a long time ago to take over for Joe after his brain stopped working altogether. If you've recently tuned into this show, you have a lot of catching up to do. Anyway, back to the story. For the Democratic establishment, she is the perfect choice to derail the emerging progressive faction of the party led by Bernie Sanders, which champions a similar brand of the social democratic politics championed by her father. This could also hold disastrous geopolitical implications, as the world is still reeling from the 4 years spent ravaged by the foreign policy of Hillary Clinton's State Department, which oversaw the wholesale destruction of several nations in the global South. We can only expect the same regime change policies from Harris if she is cut from the same cloth. Then we have a history lesson about the Frankfurt School and the rise of the New Left in the US and Western Europe. And as always, I link to the articles I read so you can go back and read the whole article later. Skipping ahead again, Maupin emphasizes that the intelligentsia of the New Left were actively supported by the Central Intelligence Agency through its clandestine Congress for Cultural Freedom, CCF, program during the Cold War, which sought to subvert the sympathies of liberals and the non-communist left with the Soviet Union through the covert funding of prominent literary magazines, journals, international conferences, modern art exhibitions, and other cultural activities. The objective was to promote an intellectual consensus on the Western left that the Soviet Union was to be opposed as much as capitalism, and it was indisputably successful. That point right there was worth reading the whole article for. Meanwhile, the Church Committee and Rockefeller Commissions of the 1970s exposed how in the previous decade the CIA had played an enormous role in introducing drugs to the counterculture as part of its domestic espionage against the anti-war movement in Operation Midnight Climax, a sub-program of Project MKUltra, where the Bay Area became a petri dish for its human experimentation. With the drug culture came the popularization of Eastern mysticism and eventually the New Age movement. The CIA did all that. And the history lesson shows us that the roots of this operation are in Germany. Skipping ahead again, prior to his work in the OSS in Weimar Germany, the young Marcuse had been a pupil of philosopher Martin Heidegger, even as his mentor infamously joined the ascendant Nazi party, though the relationship came to an end once Marcuse's own academic career was obstructed by the Third Reich in the early 1930s. One of the major thinkers associated with the New Left promoted by the CCF was a former love of Heidegger's, Hannah Arendt, who penned one of the most seminal and harmful works in equating the Soviet Union with Nazi Germany as twin pillars of authoritarianism in The Origins of Totalitarianism. In particular, Maupin takes aim at Arendt's essay Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil, where she famously observed Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann's thoughtless conformism and ministerial disposition in his lack of remorse for his atrocities while covering his trial. Maupin interprets her notion as implicitly concluding that lurking underneath the surface of every ordinary hardworking person is a potential fascist. Therefore, anyone who would try to organize them for a collective cause is a threat to society. This cynical, psychoanalytic definition of fascism, as rooted in what Adorno called the authoritarian personality, replaced the Marxist economic understanding. Yet in spite of her work, Arendt controversially participated in the shameful post-war apologia and rehabilitation of Heidegger's reputation. This is pretty deep, but it's very interesting to a geek like me. If you're a geek like me, I'll let you read the rest of the article yourself. But I will skip ahead to the conclusion. If the idea that Kamala Harris represents an apotheosis of the New Left's failures feels like a bit of a stretch, it is only because the examination warrants further inquiry, which Maupin should continue in his work, regardless of the outcome of the 2020 election. Hear, hear. Nevertheless, in just a little over 125 pages, he manages to comprehensively piece together the trajectory of the Western Left from the end of World War II to what can only be described as its stinking corpse today, a term once used by Rosa Luxemburg to describe the treacherous Social Democratic Party of Germany, SPD, after it voted to support the imperialist bloodbath of World War II in 1914. Maupin's use of Harris and the environment she grew up in as a springboard to investigate the shortcomings of the Western left generally is a formidable exploration that is desperately needed at a time where the American people are faced with the probability of enduring yet another destructive administration and no authentic left to represent it. So I not only hope you'll read this article yourselves, but I hope you'll also read the book. It sounds like we need to know what's going on from World War II until now. And anything you can find that shows you that story is worth reading. Thanks again to the regular crew, which comments under these videos, and I hope again that this deep dive was worth your time.